Welcome to the Crypto Graduate Podcast by the Stanford Blockchain Club. I'm Julianne, a student at Stanford's Graduate School of Business.
And I'm Raman, an electrical engineering PhD student at Stanford. In this podcast, we hear the personal journeys of the builders, thinkers, and doers in crypto. We learn why they started in crypto and what they did to graduate from crypto student to crypto leader. Let's get started.
We are very excited to be here with James Rathmel, a member of the founding team of Katie Hahn's new firm and formerly with A16Z's crypto team. James is a graduate of both Stanford Law School and Stanford Business School. James, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me. This is great.
Awesome. Well, we're very excited to learn about your crypto journey. So to start, James, when did you first learn about crypto?
So it's very funny. Back in 2015, when I was coming out to Stanford, I drove my Volkswagen Jetta across the country and ended up camping in a lot of like random spots throughout the country. And it was actually, I was listening to a lot of podcasts on that trip because I had a lot of road time. And it was around that time that I heard a little bit about crypto. And I remember distinctly sitting at a campsite in Black Hills, trying to get cell reception so that I could create a Coinbase account. And I ended up buying, you know, $50 of Bitcoin that day. So that was my original exposure to crypto. And then obviously, by the time I got out to Stanford, I felt much more knowledgeable about it and kept on it throughout my first year and beyond. So.
Oh, amazing. Okay. So what got you so excited about crypto that you were willing to try to find Wi-Fi on the middle of a road trip to get started?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, like, there's this thing, right, that, and you hear certain like kind of branches of the crypto world talk about this a lot. Like, crypto is ultimately like a byproduct of the 2008 financial crisis. So I was in Econ 101 in 2008 in New York when Lehman Brothers was collapsing, and I never learned anything about supply and demand. I just learned about residential mortgage-backed securities. And so, like, I definitely, much like Bitcoin, I consider myself kind of a product, a like thought product of the 2008 financial crisis. And mm-hmm. I think I just, you know, feel a lot of affinities and, or I guess just the entire kind of thought experiment of A, just, you know, solving for digital scarcity, but also, you know, thinking critically about the role of money in society and the role of scarcity in society is something that I think was really thrown into stark relief in the 2008 financial crisis. And I think that's what is so exciting about the space and so exciting about what has been built over the past 10 plus years here.
Yeah, I really identify with that story. We must have been in school right around the same time. And it's funny, a lot of people I talk to in crypto and Web3 today forget that genesis and kind of how the ethos started there, especially with the Bitcoin white paper. And so love to hear that that's a piece of your story. James, you have an unusual background for somebody in crypto. You're both a lawyer and an MBA. So I'm curious, how has your background influenced your participation and your start in crypto?
Yeah. So the interesting thing is that, like, there are so many lawyers in crypto. It's like this weird, I think the only other kind of field that has this many lawyers floating around is AI. Like, there seem to be a lot of like AI ethicists who are also lawyers. And I don't know what that says about a certain type of lawyer, but yeah, ultimately I think, you know, I'm drawn to it. I think there are some really, and this is, you know, my entire reason that I did a joint degree is that I was really excited by regulatory and policy issues at the very cutting edge of technology. And that's, you know, why I decided to pursue the joint degree. That's how I have structured my entire career effectively. And so it is those two things. I mean, there's, at the law school, you're kind of thinking critically about, I'd love to talk about this more kind of like later in this conversation, but I think you think a lot about kind of the, not that the law is just a thing that exists out there in the ether, but about what those laws are trying to accomplish and the way that you structure those laws in order to kind of create incentives, and that it's not a stagnant thing. You know, it's like a byproduct of like historical circumstances, and bad things happen and there are reactions to the bad things that happen. And that's what creates law and regulation in order to kind of protect people. And so I think that on the one hand, the legal side of the story, and then there's this, I mean, the business side of the story is ultimately a story about, you know, regulation and policy and emerging technology are all parts of the general strategy of building institutions and getting ideas and products out into the world. They're part and parcel of the same approach in terms of how you know operate in the private sector. And I think that's kind of where I tie those two things together.
Super cool. Well, maybe one more question on your experience and background, and then we're keen to move to some of these regulatory questions as well. So James, when you graduated from Stanford, you worked in law for a little bit, had exposure to a lot of different areas of law, and then you took the leap to work in crypto full-time with a16z. Would love to hear a little bit about that thought process and why you kind of made it your full-time career to be in crypto.
Yeah, it's a great question. So when I went to join the law firm that I was working at in San Francisco, I was really wanted to work in crypto and told them that up front. And unfortunately, they didn't have a crypto practice or a dedicated crypto practice. And so they basically, you know, said, hey, come work in our general corporate group and we'll also, you know, give you crypto work as much as possible. So I had some really wonderful experiences there working both as outside counsel for A16Z and also outside counsel for a number of really just exciting crypto projects and portfolio companies of various firms. There was a kind of a tide change in the middle of the pandemic where all of a sudden the capital markets became really just totally crazy. And I ended up kind of getting moved into a lot more of the IPO and SPAC work and kind of like the strict capital markets work. But crypto was always where my passion lay. And so I was very fortunate when Katie, who I TA'd for at Stanford, reached back out to me and said, you know, A16Z is building out its team, and we'd love for you to have a conversation and meet more of the team members. And that's kind of how I got moved back into the crypto world from big law. So
that's awesome.
Wonderful. Yeah.
I also wanted to chime in. It's funny because my story, like my background is just like disjoint, because you guys said you guys both were there during 2008, and yeah. I absolutely do not remember that time because I was 12 years old at the time, and I just,
the next generation.
Yeah, I'm not trying to age, you know, either of us, but I got into, you know, I'm an electrical engineer, and I feel like there's like 50% of people I meet get into it because they're like, oh, I just wanted to build this machine that gave me like free, you know, bitcoins or like money, and then the other half is like they actually understood why it's so important, but
yeah.
You know, luckily I've come a long way since then. So now I can understand why it's also important to.
No, and that's what's so exciting about it though, right? Is that you have like this entire group of people that are like, this is just an incredibly cool technical challenge. Like this is the most exciting thing I could be doing with my brain, given that I am, you know, like at the bleeding edge of like understanding cryptography and computer science. And then there's this entire group of people that's like, oh man, this is like tackling a very interesting set of social issues that are kind of like, and I think that's the cool thing about crypto, and you don't see this in many other fields, is that you do get the cross-section of those two people and they are talking, and actually both sides seem to know a little bit about what the other is doing or about what the other is doing. Like you don't, it's not so often that you meet a group of like hardcore cryptographers who like are knowledgeable about the Howey test. Like that's not, that's like, it's knowledgeable about like old case law from the 20th century. That's like, this is the unique field where that happens. So
that's precisely what like excites me probably the most in crypto. So I love the intersection. So now maybe we're just going to pivot a little bit and flesh out a little bit more about the regulatory type questions that we have for you. So just starting off strategically, what do you think are the biggest regulatory questions that crypto builders need to think about right now?
It's a great question. This goes to kind of what I was saying earlier, right? Is that ultimately regulation is not created in a vacuum. Regulation is a means to an end. And this happens both among founders and project leaders and policymakers. Sometimes they lose kind of sight of the historical contingency of things. So I think from a high level, the most important thing for people who are building the space to think about is really, what are the policy aims? Like, why do we have these regulations? You know, like what is so concerning to ex-politician or ex-policymaker? And really kind of hearing those concerns and trying to understand how regulation slots into that, as opposed to looking at the letter of the regulation and trying to unpack that as if it just like kind of existed in a vacuum, because it never exists in a vacuum. You know, nobody is ever, everything is within kind of the historical and social moment that we're in, and it will be driven by those factors. And if there is something on the books that policymakers overwhelmingly, or something not on the books that policymakers overwhelmingly want to do, they will figure out the tool set that they need to accomplish that goal. And so it's really about alignment and ongoing conversations and bridges between builders and the people who are writing and enforcing the regulations. And that's something that my colleague, Tamika Tilleman, my colleague, Chris Lehane, this is something we all believe in very strongly, is that, you know, building bridges and opening those channels of communication is the most important thing we could do in the space.
Yeah. So I guess like a follow-up on that, like if I were a crypto builder, like what are some resources perhaps that you would recommend or like that you would point to? Because I think one of the biggest disconnects, right? Like for myself as an engineer, like I can build a really cool, interesting new product. I can kind of make out why it's technically interesting or important to have, for example, for like decentralized finance or something like that. But then it's really difficult for me to think about, you know, like historically how it should be regulated and stuff like that, and like talk to lawyers about that. Perhaps like if I don't have enough money, I don't want to hire a lawyer. Are there any other resources that you would maybe want people or could point people to?
Yeah. So as a lawyer, I always need to recommend that you get your own legal advice.
Yeah. No shortcuts.
I guess I would say two things to that. So one is to this overarching policy conversation. Again, this is not happening in a vacuum. There's both stuff going on in the public media, but also, you know, there are a number of really incredible, and it's not legal free resources. It's not going to tell you like, okay, push this button. Okay, sign this form, but it helps you kind of understand the broader context in which this stuff is happening. And so not to give us a pat on the back, but me and Tamika worked on some great resources that are still available at A16Z's Policy Hub, along with just the incredible team that's over there who helped, you know, very deeply pull together some just really thoughtful and great resources. So I definitely point people there. And A16Z also has just a plethora of materials for the flip side of the coin, which is, you know, if you are non-crypto native, how do you get knowledgeable about the space and knowledgeable about what matters and kind of, you know, different issues involved there. And I think they've done just a really wonderful job of building up those resources. There are also a number of other organizations, the Blockchain Lawyers Forum. I know there's work going on at Stanford Law School around this. I think there are plenty of places where there are thoughtful lawyers who are open to having conversations, not giving you specific legal advice about, you know, do X, Y, and Z with your project, but open to having conversations about how to think about building this space. What are the large scale issues? Like, how should we be moving the policy conversation along? And I think that's, like I said, at the outset, this is a space where there seem to be an overwhelming number of lawyers relative to any other technical space. So I think those people are around, certainly at Stanford.
Yeah. Awesome.
No, I think that's great.
Yeah. We'll link to a few of those resources in the show notes for folks. Cool. So great heads up there.
Exactly. Yeah. And I've seen it more recently pop up, but a big, you know, medium of thought exchange for crypto is Twitter. And I'm like excited to see, you know, these like thoughtful people thinking about regulations and stuff like pop up on there. And every now and then I read threads by them, and it's a great resource along with the A16Z stuff. Mm-hmm. I've actually seen that as well. And you guys have done a great job on all that.
Other orgs like Coin Center does really excellent stuff. Like, I feel like I'm always learning stuff. I follow Jerry Brito on Twitter, and I think he's, you know, just an incredible thinker. Jake Trubinsky also, who just moved over to Blockchain Association. He's also just an incredible thought leader. I mean, there are some really, really thoughtful people operating in this space. My tack, because I'm always in learning mode as well, is to basically follow and talk to like the legal heads at all of the industry associations and all of the like really prominent portfolio companies in the space, not just our portfolio companies, but all of the prominent projects in the space. And they're all just across the board, just some really, really incredible talent that are thinking critically about these issues.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And then, so, you know, another question, and it's somewhat related, but it kind of builds on this older question. So startups pursue different regulatory strategies, but it seems like they break down into two categories at the moment. One is you can sort of build your product and toe the line with breaking the law. Like, you're not thinking too much about regulation, but you're like building out the tech stack, so to speak, of your product and trying to, you know, go to the bleeding edge there. And the second one is perhaps you work a lot closer to regulators right off the onset, right? And that obviously has its own pros and cons. Pros, you're basically compliant at all times, and cons, perhaps it takes a lot of capital to do that, or like just funding in order to do that. So I guess, do you, like, just thinking about like if you were to ever build a product, do you have a preference as to which way people go about starting their crypto projects?
Yeah. So I guess, and this again goes to that question around like, you know, who are the people in the space? And I guess like just off the bat, I would guess like, frankly, the vast majority of people in the space we've talked to are not trying to ignore regulation. They are really plugged in on these issues. I'm not going to say like no one has ever done that. Like I'm sure there is somebody in the crypto space who has evaded regulation, but certainly not the folks that we're talking to day in and day out. And I think that ultimately goes to the people who are drawn to the crypto space are ultimately drawn in because of the interesting technical challenge, but also the really compelling social needs. And ignoring regulation is ultimately, you're going to kind of fall flat on your face in terms of like addressing compelling social needs if you're not like thinking about the broader political ecosystem.
I don't mean like maliciously avoid regulation. Obviously, sure. Like people should not do that, just generally sure. speaking. But more so like, for example, a lot of these projects, sometimes it's beneficial protocol-wise speaking to mm-hmm. have a token, but then they don't want to, you know, worry about whether this is going to be classified as a security or something like that down the road. And, you know, they're just generally cautious and concerned with such things in terms of like tokenizing aspects of their protocol and company. So it's definitely a difficult space, right? Like it's hard to think about.
Like ultimately, I think it's that what you said is like, even those builders like find it challenging to engage with are engaging with it or are not ignoring it, you know? Ultimately, like I said, I don't know of like a founder or a builder in the space who's really kind of ignoring this slate of issues ultimately. And I think they're actually the kind of willingness to engage is certainly something that we and kind of other leading firms look at in the space. I mean, that's like ultimately part of our due diligence process, right? Is that we are looking for founders who are not ignoring this and who are looking to engage. And again, like we don't come across very many who aren't willing to engage. Like everybody seems to be like either self-trained or very willing to learn and talk to mm-hmm. folks and are seeking out resources.
Yeah, that's such a great point. Because even I feel like the classic example is like Coinbase's route, which was very closely working with regulators versus maybe a Binance or an FTX, which kind of stayed out of the US market, perhaps strategically to not deal with the regulatory burden of the US. And none of those companies have been able to avoid regulation at any point in their journeys. What I hear you saying is you're going to deal with it regardless. And so many founders are now, you see, are being proactive about getting up to speed on what they need to know from a regulatory standpoint.
Yeah. And then one other very quick one I had at the end, I do want to move forward, but regulation is so interesting to talk about. So I know plenty of protocols and, you know, people working in protocols that they really value like anonymity, right? Mm-hmm. Or even if it's just like pseudo anonymous. Yep. And I find it like, I always have this disconnect in my mind about like how you can be like really like perfectly like compliant regulatorily, like regulation wise, and yet still try to maintain anonymity. And I'm curious if there's like examples of doing that correctly, or like if you've ever thought mm-hmm. about this for people that come to you and say they want the team, for example, to be anonymous, but that's clearly maybe not the way to go if you want to be completely compliant with a lot of these things, right?
Yeah, no, it's an interesting set of issues. And I think you're seeing more and more of this. You have certain of our counterparts in the space who are kind of like really embracing it with open arms, as you can see from their like team pages. It's not something we've had to kind of like tackle head on at the moment. Like ultimately, and this kind of goes to that broader point I was making, is like ultimately it's all a conversation and it's all about social norms. And like, you know, there are ways to get there. If there are legitimate reasons to remain pseudonymous or anonymous, mm-hmm. like there are reasons, like there are ways to get there, you know? And I think there are plenty of compelling reasons that, you know, team members or community participants might be. On the flip side, you also need to like figure out ways, and this is just like the trust point is like, mm-hmm. like that. And this is not a regulatory thing. It's just like a broader, like if you are an important player in the space, like you need to build trust. And like, what are the alternative mechanisms of building trust that are not related to identity, I guess, is what I would say mm-hmm. to that. And there are plenty, and that's, you know, part of what, you know, consensus mechanisms do, is that you can build trust without, you know, knowing the identity of every single individual. But it's not a panacea. You know, it's an ongoing conversation around what is acceptable. And again, it's kind of like a tug of war. It's like you have to kind of think through it.
Yeah. So question, that's so interesting. I've been having a lot of conversations around diversity in crypto and what we can do to get, you know, people representative of our global community involved, and anonymity goes both ways. A lot of women I talk to, for example, that makes them feel kind of less safe and less trusting of communities. And for other people, they're like, that's why we're here, because it builds a more trusting system. So just these social norms that are still being kind of developed and discovered, to your earlier point, James, are still currently evolving. So
yeah, absolutely. And I think, I mean, you've almost certainly heard this line of like, oh, if I'm not doing anything wrong, like, then I don't see the need to, you know, be anonymous. And there are plenty of reasons that privacy and anonymity can be important for very good actors. And I think that is like a very valid concern, and one that, I mean, I would point to a post that Howard Wu put up on A16Z's Future about how privacy can fix the broken web. It's just a wonderful piece thinking about kind of like crypto protocols and zero knowledge proofs and how that technology can really solve a lot of the issues that people are wringing their hands about in Washington, you know, about Web2 companies, you know, like ultimately, like, it's not like our, the current status quo is so great when it comes to individual privacy. So.
Yeah.
And it's especially important when, you know, the medium you're working with is by nature a public ledger for most of these big blockchains and protocols. So you can imagine why anonymity might be important even for good actors.
It's a great point though, James. We have not figured this out. We have not figured out like anonymity and trust on the internet generally, let alone in Web3. So
I mean, there's this great, who is it? It was the CEO of Whole Foods who got in trouble in like the mid 90s for like posting on a forum, like, you know, besmirching his competitors, you know, under his like, you know, teenage daughter's handle or something. Like, this is like, this is not a crypto issue. Anonymity on the web and anonymity in society is like, this is a very, again, this is like the, you know, keep the broad historical landscape in mind, like most things we've seen before. There are some genuinely novel issues raised by this technology, but it all has to be placed in that kind of broader historical lens of like, you know, ultimately, like, well, we have seen a lot of it before, or we could kind of do pattern recognition based on history.
Yeah, super interesting. Should we move on from regulation? All right, cool. tell us where HanVC sits in the evolution of venture capital.
Yeah, so Han Ventures is ultimately what we like to think of as the kind of third generation of venture capital. It's really this kind of new up and coming wave that we think is going to be kind of at the forefront of venture capital, you know, for the coming decades. And so the way we think about this is ultimately there have been kind of three waves of venture capital over the past half century. And so you had a first wave that was really during a time of where financial capital was largely pretty scarce. And so just being able to write a check was a very meaningful contribution to entrepreneurship and innovation. And that really changed about 15 years ago, 10, 15 years ago. And I think, you know, a lot of our team came from Andreessen Horowitz, and A16Z pioneered on the model of providing kind of a more full service offering. And during a time, you know, the past 10, 15 years has been a time where financial capital has not been incredibly scarce, but social capital and support is a way that VCs could really step in and help companies and projects and entrepreneurs, you know, bring their ideas, innovations to the masses. And so you have kind of financial capital, but really the value add is this other piece, this kind of full service model. And so as we look towards the next, you know, generation of venture capital, and I think you're starting to see this among our peer firms that have just, you know, spun out in recent years or started up in recent years, is that all of us are focused on not only those two things, because it's still those two things, but it's also this idea of systems change, is that to be really good stewards of financial capital and to be supportive of entrepreneurs and founders and builders, you need to take a systems approach. You need to take a holistic view and think about how technology and innovation is going to exist in society in a long-term and in a long-term way that is, you know, ultimately beneficial and is ultimately, you know, sustainable in the very broadest sense of the word, is that it is something that can persist over many, many years and many, many decades. And so what we think about our firm doing is bringing systems change to Web3 and getting billions of people on board with something that we think is going to have a profoundly positive impact on society.
Can you say anything about Han Ventures wants to be a venture contributor? Can you say anything about broadly the investment theses that you're looking at within Web3?
Yeah. So ultimately, like, we are interested in bringing crypto and Web3 to the next billion users. And so What is necessarily going to have to happen is really innovation across the stack. So we are kind of broadly investing in, you know, picks and shovels companies, and then everything from layer one to application layer protocols. So really, we are taking a very wide scope in terms of what we're investing in, but with this very, you know, narrow objective, which is really helping to realize the promise of Web3, which we think is ultimately kind of fixes a lot of the deficiencies of the last generation of the internet, and fixes a lot of the deficiencies that I think people across the country and around the world have seen with how we did tech innovation in the last wave of internet invasion. So that's the very broadly writ investment thesis that we're going at. But what this means in practice is really what we're looking at: teams that are building incredibly high impact projects that are doing something unique in terms of getting exciting Web3 projects in the hands of new users.
Awesome. And you and I have spoken a little bit about this offline. I'm curious if you could name kind of the one thing that Han Ventures is better at than every other VC firm. What's that one thing?
I think it's the building bridges. The firm is named after Katie. This is Katie's like superpower, is that she is able to bring together a room full of people that you would never have expected to be in a room together and get them productively all rowing in the same direction. And so that's really, that carries on to everything we do as a firm when it comes to connecting our LPs with, you know, the new up and coming founders to talk through, you know, critical issues in the space, when it comes to, you know, our advisors who are just this slate of like total Navy SEALs from across a number of different industries. You know, we have folks from entertainment, we have folks from who have been in government service for their entire careers. We have folks who are asset allocators, and all of these are kind of like, and then we have technologists. We have some just incredible, incredible technologists on our advisory board, and getting all of those advisors, all of our LPs, all of our portfolio companies, and everybody else who is impacted by Web3 or who wants to be part of the community, and getting them all in the same room and really kind of, you know, pushing the whole thing forward is the way that we're going to be successful. I mean, that's ultimately like, you know, the way we bring about systems change, and the way that we bring about system change, and ultimately the way that we, you know, bring transformative innovation to the world, and the way that our projects are going to be successful.
Awesome. And maybe one last question. Speaking to all the entrepreneurs out there who want to work with Han Ventures, what should they know about working with you?
What should they know about working with us? We move very fast. We move very fast.
And we had to get in touch with you.
Yeah, no, I think, I mean, it's a really just an incredible team. The crazy thing is that we are so kind of like fresh and nimble. I think we're like a strike force. That's the way that I would characterize us, is that we have just like the best of the best from every part of, from in terms of any expertise that you would need. Like in terms of, we have just the most amazing marketing and communications team. We have the most amazing technologists. We have the most amazing policy thinkers and strategy thinkers in the space. And we move very fast and nimbly, and we help our portfolio companies really execute very effectively without a lot of unnecessary motions or unnecessary kind of mechanics to slow things down. So
awesome. And so James, in your experience, you've invested both in kind of tokens and communities, and I would imagine in kind of stock in these companies running decentralized or crypto-based projects?
So I can't talk about, I'm on the operations side, so I'm not the investing side. But yeah, and you see this across the space, is like ultimately people are investing in both tokens and securities. And because ultimately like the value will accrue to different places with different projects. Sometimes you just have, you know, equity in the company and it's a management team that is building a thing.
Yeah.
And sometimes there is an entire decentralized community that's evolving an open source protocol, and mm-hmm. in that case, value is accruing to, you know, the governance or utility token on the network. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And we touched on this point briefly in kind of the last conversation, but one thing I do think is so fascinating about Web3 is how you incentivize your different community members, whether they be your active participants or your founders or your investors, where, you know, today in the public markets, it's largely institutional investors and certainly some retail investors plus the company, but very little to none of the community members. So from your perspective as an investor, how do you balance this? I'm an investor looking to get returns, plus I know that a lot of the value will accrue to the community members. How do you take a long-term view of that? And how have you had to shift your thinking from a Web 2 world to a Web 3 world to get yourself comfortable in this new landscape?
Yeah, no, it's an interesting question.
The opposite of the short questions I've been trying to ask. So sorry about that.
Yeah. I think, and that's where you kind of move from, like, you know, we were talking to somebody who said they're only looking for venture contributors. And that's like kind of where you move from, like, venture capital to venture contributor. It's like the money is no longer the scarce thing. And it's like, how do you be a good community participant? And like, and if you're not aligned with the community, like, and if the community doesn't have the appropriate, like, tokenomics and appropriate incentives and isn't thinking critically about how they're allocating to tokens and incentivizing people's, like, destroys the entire promise of the protocol, right? And so I think you get these really incredible network flywheel effects when everything is working really smoothly and everybody is, like, you know, everybody's incentives are reinforcing other people's incentives, and there's just incredible participation across the network. Yeah, I don't see, it's a question about, you know, each individual protocol and how they're creating those incentives. Yeah. And I think that's another thing that we look at in our diligence, right? Is like, what is the tokenomic model? How do we make sure that that we're aligned with the community? Because it's very important that we're aligned with the community. Otherwise, like, everybody loses, you know, and this thing will never achieve escape velocity.
Yeah, I love that. And I love that it's built into how everybody, you know, participates and makes money together. Like, what a way to increase economic empowerment when all those incentives align. That makes a ton of sense.
It's like the wag me, right? Like, we're all going to.
That's
what they say in crypto all the time. It's like, it's great to see, like, you know, maybe in the future, like, you know, the investors will be also in the discords and talking, which I'm sure maybe already happens at some point.
I think we're in a bunch of the discords. I am personally not in the discords, but we are. So
That's great. I mean, it just, like, opens this channel of communication and openness, which is, like, amazing.
Yeah. I mean, that's so much great information that you have available to you with these Discord communities to just participate and get started. And I can't think of a public or private company with as open of data on, you know, how they're doing. So building in public really helps everybody. And
I get, like, super excited about, right, is that, and it's certainly, like, a conversation that we've had with policymakers, is that, like, if you think about the challenges and opportunities of the 20th century, it was, like, I think there were a lot of concerns around, like, misaligned incentives between, you know, management team and the board, management team and the board and the public, and management team, the board and large investors. And there's, like, all of these ways that policymakers tried to work through that by implementing regulation. And then all of a sudden, and I think this is where you get into truly revolutionary space, is that, like, all of a sudden you have an open source protocol where literally anybody can hop on and see what's happening and participate, and nobody has any sort of, like, special inside information. And, like, what are the risks inherent in that? There are new risks for sure. But, like, what are the opportunities where we can, like, this actually solves for a lot of the risks that we used to have to deal with through regulation, you know? And I think that's really one of the wonderful magical things here, is that, especially when you think about the ESG movement that's happening right now, like, that is an uphill battle in the way our institutions work and the way people get to participate in the most powerful institutions in our society. And and you do have a new model that is demonstrating that there is a different route, a more participatory route, a more community-based route, that one that's much more grassroots and one that's much more inclusive. And it's working. It appears to be working so far. Again, like, what are the opportunities there? And, like, for sure, there are, like, a different set of risks. And, like, how do we mitigate this risk? You know, how do we think, like, I think that operational side of things is probably, and we've seen this in the space over and over again, is, like, the operational side of things, like, how do you diligence the technical aspect of protocols? That's going to be, like, the big one, you know? And it's less about, like, specialized information and more about, like, making sure that the thing functions as it's supposed to, you know?
It's like easier to be an informed investor in some sense, right? Like, because, for example, I'm in a lot of discords of, like, protocols that I personally enjoy. And it's cool to just, like, exactly, like, see regulatory, like, people that know it way better than I do, right? Mm-hmm. Like come in and like have nice little write-ups there for you. And it's just easier than reading like quarterly reports of like, you know, NVIDIA or like Apple, which come out once a quarter.
I think that's a great point. Yeah, and this is not a point about securities, but this is about a point about like how information gets out in society around our most important institutions. And that's where you get into like, okay, so like you have a 10K or you have some sort of other report or you have a filing with a government agency or any of these things. And it's like, we've decided that there's a certain way these need to be structured. And that's been very successful for developing out, you know, our capital markets and our institutions and how the community participates, but like ultimately probably an ill fit for like this new world where information is getting disseminated in a different way.
Yeah. Yeah. Such a great point. And you can, to your earlier point, James, you can see how so much of our current regulation around securities is a remnant of the Great Depression and how so much of it is about equal or increasing access to information for all different parties. And now we're met with a world where that is built in. So then from a regulatory standpoint, how do you incorporate that for the long term?
But it also goes to your point around, you know, trust and anonymity. Is that like these are all trust-based mechanisms. It's like ensuring equal access to information, but it's, you also have this huge trust component. You know, it's absolutely fascinating. And I think we are in a brave new world when it comes to really breaking the model of how institutions can be powerful, like positive players in the space by creating better governance and inclusion. And that, you know, maybe kind of ossifying over and adding like, you know, bells and whistles to like the current ways our institutions are governed and saying, you have to fill out an ESG report. Like maybe that's not the answer. Maybe it's something that is more like fundamental to how like institutions are set up and operate that we need. Maybe that's the answer. And I think, you know, one for like kind of getting to the root of the problem as opposed to like, you know, trying to like, you know, bells and whistles to try to solve for things. So that's one where, again, another reason I'm very excited about the space.
Yeah. Well, maybe we should dig into the ESG stuff a little bit, because I know we wanted to talk about that. This is my total finance nerd coming out, but they are doing some really interesting work around accounting standards and how you layer in, like the accounting board nationally is working on how you layer in ESG standards. And I think there's a professor at Stanford Business School. I think it's Susan Athey, but it might be someone else who's helping lead kind of that charge. So, you know, we're working at it from all different angles.
Awesome. Yeah.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah, so. No, for sure. And I think that's going to be fundamental to the work of like TCFD or other organizations in terms of how we're doing climate disclosures. I mean, it goes very much to this point, you know, of like, you know, how do you measure and report on climate impact when there is that specialized information? But then there's this other piece of the puzzle, which is like, what if there's no specialized information? How does the community get together and figure out what, I mean, there was a very cool post on MakerDAO last fall around clean money, the case for clean money.
Oh, cool.
And so this is a, you know, fully decentralized community that is trying to grapple with how its protocol is going to contribute to the climate crisis or contribute to solving the climate crisis. And it's all happening right out there in the open, you know? And it's like, you know, there's all of the data is on chain and you can probably, like, you don't need, you know, a team, an accounting team in a back room to try to figure out what the climate impact of Maker's protocol is. Like it can actually happen out there in public and people can jump in and try to push it in the right direction.
Yeah, love that example.
So yeah, I think this perfectly kind of feeds in. So basically we have this, we're trying to have some, you know, regular segments just to give some continuity between episodes.
Cool.
And one of them is it's more on the fun side, but it's just called Bear Talk, right? So, you know, as someone in crypto and like we're on crypto, I'm sure like, you know, many people walk up to us and they have these like very common, we call them FUDs. So like fear, uncertainty, and doubts, right? And I think it would be fun just to have our guests answers to like two of the most common such FUDs. So the first one is it's ESG related. So like, you know, I have plenty of people who walk up to me and they're just like, I've heard of Bitcoin, but you know, I don't want to think about it any further just because of how much energy it takes. And, you know, they're concerned about the environment. And of course we all are concerned about the environment. So I'm just curious, like what your most common answer to someone that walks up to you asking about energy is in terms of like how you think about it.
Yeah, it's twofold. I mean, when it comes to Bitcoin, I think what you're seeing is that there are some, so A, like renewable usage on the Bitcoin blockchain is like significantly higher than the energy grid at large. And actually what you see is that like, it's a way of kind of rapidly turning on and off and using excess energy, or kind of like, it can be a way of grid balancing. And so, I mean, that's the interesting point about Bitcoin. And I know there's like kind of ongoing research into that. And the Bitcoin community is largely like very engaged with this issue, as you can see on Twitter and elsewhere. Yeah. The second answer is just that, you know, a lot of the protocols that we're investing in are you know, proof of stake or other consensus mechanisms that are not as energy intensive. And I think that is a direction. Certainly Ethereum is moving in that direction. And there are a number of other very large protocols that are either, I mean, Solana is a really interesting one. They just went carbon neutral. Celo is another one that just went carbon neutral and are very engaged on this issue. So I think that's a little bit of a misconception that we're trying to remedy in our conversations.
Yeah, absolutely. And then, so the second FUD I have is like the regulatory FUD, right? So a lot of people think that it's the ultimate crypto killer. And I think you're probably the, you know, the most apt at answering this or like providing a good rebuttal to this. And specifically, for example, like I have plenty of people walk up to me and they're like, when the central bank digital currency is issued, like, is that just an absolute game over? And, you know, I have my answer, but of course you, I want to hear yours. So I'm curious.
Yeah, no, I mean, like not to get too, this was a little bit my point earlier about like, this is a technology that I think other than like something like healthcare, like genomics is probably another area where people just like have a lot of like gut reactions. But when you're talking about like money is power and, you know, like the way in which money exists in society is obviously just going to raise a lot of scrutiny and has from day one around Bitcoin. Like this isn't, it's not like anybody took this lightly from day one. So A, like there are just an overwhelming number and an increasing number of policymakers who are really excited about the technology and who are engaging it with it in a meaningful way. And so like, I think it's like, I would be astonished if, and I think that would be astonished if, you know, policymakers decided that they were just going to turn off the switch. And I don't even know that that would be possible at this stage. Like that's one. And I think we're just too late in the game. There was a point in time at which things were small and like, yeah, possibly regulation could have just killed the entire thing. I think we're past that point. And it's really about like making sure that we're using regulation in a really thoughtful way to achieve our social goals and our policy goals. And that's like the conversation we're having because that is incredibly important that like this industry will not take off unless it has proper regulation. It's already taking off, but it's like, it will not reach the mainstream adoption that we are expecting to reach without appropriate regulation in place to ensure that it like achieves really good societal goals. So that's one. The central bank digital currency point, I think that's just like a whole, I'm not going to go down that wormhole. it's just really interesting because like we have central bank digital money, like everything is bits in different accounts and ledgers. It's just like, I think there's a really big ongoing question at the Fed and in Washington that people are trying to grapple with is like, what is the case for central bank digital currency? And the answer that most folks are coming up with is that it's like for retail payments, you know, like, but all of a sudden, like that seems anti-American and anti-free world to me, the idea that the central bank of the United States would be controlling our retail payment rails, you know? And so it just seems like I think when you double click into it, you're like, that's really the only reason to like change our existing system. And so I don't know, it's a little bit, I think it's again, a misconception about the way our payment rails actually operate and how banking works in this country, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. No, this is great. I'm going to walk around with this clip because, you know, it's just, I walk around and they just don't believe anything from an electrical engineering PhD about any of this. I'm sure they're going to believe you. So it's great.
Cool. Awesome. So we're just going to wrap up with a few more fun questions. So we have quick fire, choose one questions coming up. So James, important questions, East Coast or West Coast?
Oh, West Coast. I left the East Coast behind now 7 years ago, and I don't think I'm going back anytime soon.
No looking back. Morning person or night owl?
Oh, night owl, much to the chagrin of my partner, who is a morning person. We were actually just talking about 10 minutes ago about how we're like rapidly diverging, and we're almost going to have full day-night separation in the next couple of years.
Oh, no. Okay, maybe this is an easy one. Web 2 or Web 3?
Hey, definitely. Would you need to say more about that answer?
I think that's what the podcast was for, yeah. Law or business?
Oh, man, that's so hard.
What's your gut say?
My gut says a little business. I think I'm a little skewed towards business. I cannot get excited about the law in the abstract, as I have been talking about on this podcast. I think the law is a means to an end. And I think, you know, it's part of the greater business and social toolkit we have.
Awesome. Regulation heavy or regulation light?
The appropriate regulation, I think I will my previous answer is that I think we'll need regulation for this space, and it's very important to get that regulation right.
I think that's a very lawyer answer. Yeah.
Oh, no.
That was your law. No, your business side. ICO or IPO?
Oh, are we still calling them ICOs?
I don't know. Token offerings or IPOs?
They now have like IDOs as well, you know?
Initial
like the DAO token. DAO
offering. Oh, interesting. Yeah. I would say crypto over both.
Yeah. Okay. Last one like this. DAOs or companies?
I'm more excited about DAOs. I think DAOs, for many of the reasons I just talked about in terms of like really changing the landscape around governance of institutions.
And probably the most important question we have for you, Bored Ape or CryptoPunk?
Ape or CryptoPunk? Oh my God. Wait, that's so hard. I guess I'm a little more into the Bored Apes these days.
Okay, cool.
We're like Pudgy Penguins, maybe? I don't know.
We like doodles over here, personally.
I'm a doodler, so I'm biased towards doodles. But yes.
Yeah, awesome. Yeah, no. My favorite moment in my first week at A16Z was I had just gone off my law job. And so I was like transitioning from basically just slaving over like Word documents and like, you know, doing word processing effectively. And at one point, during my first week at A16Z, my partner came over and looked at my computer screen, and it was just Pudgy Penguins. And she's like, oh, your career has really changed.
Amazing.
Oh, so good.
The penguins are cute.
They're great.
Great. And then now to wrap up, just two more questions. So one, what book are you currently reading, or what's the last book you read? Either of those.
Oh, it's been a slow quarter for reading with going on.
That's why I added in what's the last book you read, because if anyone asks me what book I'm currently reading, it's just nothing. So
yeah,
this question gives people the most consternation, because everyone's like, oh my God.
I know, it's hard. I believe the last book I read is Dune. I finally read many, many recommendations from, you know, friends and basically anybody with a brain. And I'm very glad I did. I think it's just a really wonderful, just, you know, fascinating novel. So yeah, I'm pretty sure that was the last one. But
nice. Awesome. And then what is one thing you do without fail every day?
I've done Wordle every day.
That's good.
No, it's funny. There's, I forget where this post was. There was a really great blog post once about how like routine is the only thing that can like break you from your animal whims. And that's like how you are like a rigorous person. I've always aspired to be somebody who has good habits and routines. And I like have never gotten there. I'm very like, kind of like seat of my pants, you know, whatever comes up, and maintain a lot of flexibility with all of my day-to-day stuff. So.
Awesome. I think this is a question that like flexibility works really well for some people, and stability works way better for others.
Yeah. I was going to say, I've also met plenty of people that lean the flexibility side, but then when you probe into their day-to-day routine, you're like, oh no, like you've got habits, you've got more structure than I've got, and I like to consider myself a structured person.
Lately it might be Wordle.
Well, James, thank you so much for joining us today. I've learned a ton, and I'm sure our listeners will as well. We so appreciate you giving us some time and energy.
This was great. Yeah. Really appreciate you guys having me on, and it's been a lot of fun.
Yeah. Awesome.
Thanks for joining.
Great. All right.
The views expressed by guests and hosts on their podcast are their own and not reflective of their organization or affiliates. And please keep in mind, the podcast guests and hosts are not providing investment advice. Thanks.
Thank you for making it to the end of the episode brought to you by Stanford's Blockchain Club. If you enjoyed the content, please do give us a follow We look forward to bringing more interviews from great speakers in the coming weeks.